while back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son. If your pants were undone, 'cause you were bred for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day. So as you push off from the shore, won't you turn your head once more and make your peace with everyone? But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the things they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you feel you have to pray. Looking for a sign that the universal mind has written you into the passion play. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day.
And once more, here we are on the thin ice of a new day here at KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I'll be with you for the next hour. And we have a repeat performance. Last week was kind of fell through the thin ice there between technical difficulties and a hurricane impending on Belize, where our guest was at that time. Yes, we have Guy McPherson back on with us with a clear signal, a landline, I believe from Tacoma, Washington. So we're going to have a full hour. Guy McPherson, ecologist and evolutionary biologist, who talks about some very difficult subjects. And I would like to, you know, I'd like to really encourage people who might be skeptical of what he has to say, might, for whatever reason, just not want to go there. I know there are so many incredibly difficult things we're facing here in Portland with the rent crisis, housing crisis, with the police crisis, with so many things that we're all facing, just the difficult economic situation so many people are in, with so many things that we all have on our plates, and so many good people fighting good struggles, difficult struggles, that in no way my focus on climate change for the past couple months and my focus, strong focus on fossil fuel, the struggle against fossil fuel infrastructure, no way diminishes or wants to crowd out any other issues. The goal is for all of us to fight the empire and the capitalist beast, whatever you want to call it, that we're fighting together and become stronger as we're doing it. So with that, I do encourage everyone to stay on the line to engage in this discussion that I think is so important to face squarely. And obviously Guy does too, because he's been dealing with it so many years now. Guy, good morning.
Good morning, Paul. It's a pleasure to chat with you again today.
Yes, and you were just in Portland, and you had a really very full and animated a discussion and event at the Waypost on Monday. Small venue, but just packed to the gills there. I don't know how many people. It seemed like there may be even a 100 or more people there in that small space. A lot of good discussion, and your presentation, compelling. And I want to go into a number of topics. Obviously, we want to get into the subject of abrupt climate change, because that is what you focus on. But I want to talk about some of the other things you talk about. I know you've learned over the years that the way you present something is as important as what it is you're presenting. And so I want to give people a chance to, and I know you've gotten into the whole issue of grief counseling, or dealing with grief and loss. So a lot of it based on the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So we'll get into that more towards the end, but I just want to give everybody a chance to call in and engage with you, ask you difficult questions, ask you anything they want. 503-231-8187. That's the number. So because last week we didn't really have a chance to sort of get into the flow of, what you've been talking about all the years, let's just get right into that and see where it goes and see who calls in. Abrupt climate change, what is it?
Abrupt climate change is a sudden increase in global average temperature, or I suppose a decrease in global average temperature. The increase, at least, has precedence in Earth's history, with a 5 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise in a span of only 13 years, according to a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is some 56 million years ago, so well before there was anything resembling a human being on the planet. But there is precedence in planetary history for the kinds of events we are seeing unfold now. So from a scientific perspective, it shouldn't come as a big surprise. And in addition, there have been two relatively stable states for extended periods of time, and here I'm talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of years throughout planetary history during the last 2 billion years. And those stable states are at what I call hothouse, 22 degrees Celsius, or about 74 degrees Fahrenheit global average temperature, and ice age, or about 12 degrees Celsius global average temperature. So Earth tends to vacillate between those two temperatures and stay there and move relatively suddenly between them. So abrupt climate change is underway right now. We're in the early stages of abrupt climate change. We're going there's virtual certainty at this point that we're going to see a very, very sudden rise in global average temperature within a very short period of time from the perspective of human beings.
Yeah, there's a site I went to just now, CO2 Earth, which kind of really lays out really clearly with graphs and images the rise. Because, we're talking about, there's the old phrase, the devil is in the details. And to study scientific details is not for everyone. I resist it. We're talking about things like what seem like small incremental rises in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere leading to non-linear effects, which is something we talked about last week and is a very important concept we need to get into, because that's what abrupt climate change is all about, is these interacting multiple feedback loops. So we need to define what feedback loops is. But anyway, CO2 Earth, it was talked about, the organization 350.org, which we'll talk about in the program, talked about 350 parts per million as in some ways a point of no return, a point that should not, in some ways cannot be passed. But of course, we passed that a number of years ago. And we passed 400 parts per million a few months ago. Now, today, I believe we're at 403.29. And these things seem kind of arcane. And, if you don't focus in on them and look at what they really mean in terms of the overall, the very extremely complex climate system of the Earth, it might not mean that much to people. But We'll carry on that conversation once we get Sean's comment or question. Go ahead, Sean.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning to your guest. Paul, I just wanted to praise you for doing these shows because I don't see any contradiction whatsoever in talking about the ecological crisis along with the crisis of poverty and homelessness and so on. I guess I'm going to attempt to do the unimaginable and unforgivable. I'm going to suggest that, you know, often people talk about a Manhattan Project or a Moonshot Project or something like that. I'd simply like to recommend a dictatorship of the proletariat. That seems to be the most unpopular thing to say right now, but I can't imagine how, other than having economic central planning, state socialism, that's the only way to encompass both the ecological crisis as well as the crisis of the exploitation of workers and impoverishment of humanity. So I realize people, they'll roll out the trope of the old Soviet Union and the ecological damage that was done in that case. However, I don't think that holds up because that was a situation in which you had a feudalistic society desperate to modernize in order to defend itself from fascist assault. So I don't think you can say that state socialism has no answer for ecological crisis based on the Soviet Union. I can't see any other way other than a dictatorship of the proletariat for answering all of these questions.
Well,
so I'll leave it at that.
Let me just, before I let Guy take over, I think that might be now a somewhat unfortunate phrase, the dictatorship of the proletariat. We might need to update our thinking in our language. You know, in principle, I think what you're saying is absolutely important and needs to be addressed. But Guy, what do you think of that?
We currently have a handful of central banks and perhaps a similar number of individual people who are almost exclusively pulling the strings of empire, including control of governments around the world. I wrote a book that was published in 2005, early 2005. It was actually written 2003, 2004, in which I pointed out that the United States at that time was deep in the throes of a totalitarian state. So I think we're already there. I think we've been there for a while, and I don't see it really fixing anything. In fact, things have not gotten better in the last 10 or 12 years. So I think we're there. I think that we have a totalitarian government or series of governments that are working in collaboration with each other. And, I mean, could it get worse? Sure. Will that make things better? It would surprise me. We've known for a while now that the only collapse of civilization prevents runaway climate change. I don't see any government in any form taking on that task of actually telling the people that we need to collapse this set of living arrangements if we're going to have any life, any complex life at all on the planet.
Well, let me just take up Sean's argument, because I think he's saying something somewhat different than maybe what you're interpreting. I'm not sure exactly. This is a very difficult discussion, certainly one to have between me here in the studio and you there sitting on the phone up in Washington State, and Sean, wherever he is listening now. But the idea of taking power from the oligarchs and the central banks and redistributing power, and the idea of actually, you know, the quixotic and probably totally utopian fantasy of dismantling the empire rather than collapsing it. That was one of my fantasies 25 or 30 years ago, among various other fantasies, like, you know, the collapse of the whole machine, the mega machine, as Lewis Mumford calls it, and seems to be what you've called for at times. You know, that idea is in principle not necessarily a bad idea. It just seems to me as unrealistic as any other scenario. It just seems like there's just so much inertial weight of the whole thing, and the ability of people to self-organize on a mass level has been undermined rather than strengthened by what's gone on.
Yes to all of the above, and I think it falls into the category of should. You know, we should be doing this, or we should be doing that, or we shouldn't be doing one thing, and we should be doing another thing. But we aren't doing any of those things. weren't doing any of those things that we should have been doing for the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years. Instead, we're immersed in civilization, a truly omnicidal set of living arrangements. And I don't see a lot of people calling for a wholesale reorganization of this set of living arrangements. And I don't see there being 27 people that would follow that lead anyway.
Well, let's just leave that thought there and see where it goes. Jeff is next. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, well, thank you for the show. I did go to the Waypost. I listened to the to your presentation. We'll ahead leave before the discussion. Very interesting, and I very sadly am accepting your hypothesis that the point of no return has been crossed. What interests me, and I suppose this is selfish, but is how it's, you know, on what time scale and how this is going to happen as someone who has to take care of children and grandchildren. How is this going to unfold to affect their lives? And whatever you can tell me, I'd appreciate, and I'll be happy to take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, that's the $64 million question. I get it almost every day, sometimes several dozen times a day. Predictions are tough, especially about the future, as Yogi Berra pointed out. I think it was him. And so it's difficult for us to accurately identify what's going to happen next week, next month, next year, much less over the course of the next decade or so. And this is why I discourage the four-letter words hope and fear, because those are just the twin sides of the I can't predict the future coin, but I'm going to wish for something to work out, or I'm going to fear something's going to happen in the future. Instead of capitulating to ideas about the future over which we have no control, I encourage people to live in the now. That doesn't mean, you know, that I'm not still flossing my teeth. I am. I'm taking these steps to live in the moment to the greatest extent possible in this society, while also anticipating and trying to create the best future I can imagine for the people around me and for the living planet around me. I don't know what that means in your case. From day to day, I have a major struggle trying to figure out what it means in my case. So it's, you know, living is hard. So far, it beats the alternative, at least for me, as nearly as I can tell. But I'm not going to make any predictions about how this is going to play out over the course of the next few months or few years, other than to say our lives are going to be short. They are necessarily short, and we should live with that urgency in mind. That's really my whole message.
Well, one thing I can say is that clearly, if you look at what's happening with these rain bombs, is this, you know, it's amazing that our language, our phraseology has to adapt itself to the new circumstances. Who would have talked about rain bombs even, you know, a year or two ago? It's a phenomenon that is clearly related to the vast increase in water vapor in the atmosphere due to the rising temperatures and super saturation of the atmosphere by water, and it by necessity having to just come down in these cascades in, you know, 2 years in a few hours of rainfall, stuff like that, or, you know, in a 6 months in a day, or things like that that are happening. I think just I saw a thing just yesterday. There's four just unprecedented flood situations going on like right now or yesterday on the planet. So, you know, or, you know, super fires, a new phrase that's come into being, or superstorm, you know. And these things, we see what they do to the infrastructure of civilization, whether they be roads, whether they be railroads, whether they be airports. You know, we have yet to see, you know, what happens when a super tornado hits an airport, or you name it. So obviously infrastructure of civilization, or whatever you want to call it, industrial civilization, modern society, is severely impacted by these events. So you can just imagine taking that out into the future. It's not that difficult to see. So with that, let's go to Dorothy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Guy. This is Dorothy in the interior of a large continent.
Hi, Dorothy.
Glad to finally meet you. One of the things that I saw the other day that kind of blew me away was a NOAA projection that looked like they thought that the breadbasket would just move north to the Great Lakes region after the interiors heat up too much. You're an evolutionary biologist. I don't see corn growing up around the Great Lakes. What's that going to do to the plants? I'll get off air at this point.
Yeah, I don't foresee growing corn outside of the mollic soils, the mollisols, on which the corn has been so productive in the recent past. I mean, the Great Plains of the United States developed over tens of thousands of years. Certainly over the soil has developed in a certain way to become incredibly productive, enriched by organic matter with a certain structure and texture since the ice receded after the last ice age. Those same soils are not found further north. In fact, what you find further north, if you get up far enough, of course, you get into permafrost, and there's been very, very limited soil development there. And even before you get there, you get into spodosols underneath those pine trees that are extremely acidic. One of the reasons, perhaps the primary reason, civilization teeters on the brink right now is that this civilization, like others, depends upon the ability to grow and store grains. And in our case, the grains are grown in the interior of large continents, almost exclusively in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're talking about places like China and Russia and the United States. You can't just move those plants upon which civilization depends to areas that don't have the soils that won't support them. And we aren't going to grow them in greenhouses. It's just the scale is way too mismatched for the phenomena people come to me with solutions about. So I just don't see us growing grains in places where grains are not currently grown anytime in the future. And we don't have long into the future to try to deal with this predicament.
Yeah, and that time scale, I know you discussed in your presentation, you leaned fairly heavily to what we talked about last week, was this person or persons, you'll have the name, but who are putting together, compiling the various components of what lead to the temperature increase, and of course all interactive, the various feedback mechanisms, especially the loss of the Arctic sea ice, loss of forests, as we go off of coal, let alone if there are major, you know, collapse scenarios wherever they are of industrial centers that lead to deindustrialization, the loss of the particulate matter in the atmosphere, which has paradoxically been the flip side of the coin of the pumping of CO2 in the atmosphere for the last 250 years or whatever, has the particulates have actually masked the solar radiation entering the atmosphere. And so when that diminishes, which it already is apparently from the slowing down of coal use, then that will increase solar radiation, plus a number of other things. We can go into that hopefully as we have time in this program. But anyway, you talk about a certain time frame that is as these things are kicking into effect, these feedback mechanisms, the time scale is diminishing in terms of what people thought even 5 or 10 years ago as to the possible scenarios. So we can talk about that. But I did want to really privilege the listeners to get their questions in. So let's go to Russell. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul and Guy, how are you guys today?
Thanks.
My question is, I'm a transplant to Portland from Chicago. Chicago, we don't really emphasize recycling or a lot of the environmental things that are done around here. So I'm a little bit behind the times in a lot of this stuff. In fact, I worked for a railroad for 20 years. I noticed we were sending so much sand all across the country. And, of course, that's beside the point. But anyway, I got out here and I ended up working for a railroad operations school. It turned out that while I was there, one of the things the boss asked us to do was to sign a petition in favor of the Vancouver oil terminal. I did that. I felt disgusted. I felt disgusted that the school wasn't placing anyone, so I quit. My problem is when you talk about these dire scenarios, and then you talked about right living last week. I listened to you on Monday at the evening show. I don't know how to do that except for to get into my own world of being serene, just being calm. Because we've all made mistakes. We've all done things to excess in terms of harming our planet. And I just don't know really how. Could you talk more about how you proceed along that path other than talking to people that don't want to hear what you have to say? How do you live with yourself and learn every day and provide for your family in this dire situation?
Yeah, what's wrong with all that? I mean, I don't, you know, we were all born into this. As my friend Tim Bennett likes to say, we were born into captivity. We didn't know what we were doing. We just showed up here. We're born into this set of living arrangements that preceded us, that continues like a mega machine. We're just caught up in the flow going down the river. It's almost impossible to escape because the current is so strong. Taking a countercultural approach is not encouraged, to say the least. So what do we have? We have the ability to try to take right action, to do the right things for the people and the planet around us. Will that work out? Almost certainly not. Should we do it anyway? I would think so. And should we act as if our hair is on fire in the meantime, or should we remain calm, remain serene, and try to pursue the best life we can imagine pursuing in the meantime? I mean, that's really my whole message. We don't have long, so let's live with urgency and act with compassion and treat people with respect and so on. And of course, we've all failed. You know, I'm not some sort of angelic guru who actually lives my message on an every moment basis. I've made horrible mistakes. I've treated people really badly. I've disrespected people and the planet. And I am aware of all of that, and I try to do better every day. I don't think we can do any better than that, recognizing that, as Nietzsche pointed out, we are flawed human beings. So how to deal with that? I don't know the full answer. I don't know it for me, much less for you. But this is a predicament. I'm just recommending ways of action that I think could have been followed and have been followed by a lot of people for a long time. That's really it.
Well, you mentioned love and excellence has kind of boiled down to two things, and I took that in my own way, as we all do. Certainly, I know I've certainly failed at love, and I'm struggling to do better with that. And excellence—that's always the challenge. But the caller mentioned the Vancouver oil terminal. I say let's stop it. we don't. What's that? I don't want it. The Sam I am. I don't want it here. I don't want it there. I don't want it tomorrow. I don't want it in 2 years. I think we'll live better, you know, for the foreseeable future without an oil terminal in Vancouver. Just as we'll do better in Portland without the propane terminal, Coos Bay will certainly do better without an LNG terminal. So, you know, if you're activistically inclined, I'd say shoot for excellence. If you're whatever your sphere. And if you're on the treadmill and want to get off it, find support. You know, we need to, mutual aid is the old anarchist slogan. It's always been true, and it's never been more true. So with that, let's go to Mike. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I tuned in a little bit late, but I heard people talking about governmental solutions. And I really believe we have the best government on the planet. We just need to get out there and force and make them do what they need to do. I don't know how we're going to doing that, because we have to fight the Fox media and all the rest of these crazy right-wing people that claim to be media that aren't media. But this government would work the way it's supposed to if everybody would jump in and participate.
Well, just out of curiosity, one quick pushback. So on what basis is this government the best on the planet?
Well, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights.
No, I'm talking about effects. I'm talking about effects. I'm not talking about like the ideal. I'm talking about actually, if you look around you, what evidence is there that this is actually, this government has led to the best set of social arrangements and treatment of people and other living beings and ecosystems than other governments?
Well, that's an incredible point, and you're absolutely right. But I think the reason for it is because people have stopped participating in the process. Uh-huh. And so the people that, they had separation, church and state. What we have to accomplish is separation of big business and state, They've totally taken it over.
And well, I think that's embedded in the Constitution personally, but that's a big subject. Guy, interact with Mike on this. What do you think?
I think this is in the category of should. Again, I don't think we have the government our founders had in mind. And maybe the government the founders had in mind that was designed by a bunch of heterosexual white men is actually benefiting heterosexual white men to a greater extent than it's benefiting others, and certainly better than it's benefiting the living planet. So not only do I not believe this is the best we can do, but I think that people tell me all the time the system is broken. I don't think the system is broken. I think it's fixed. I think it's fixed for people, not including you and me, but it's fixed. It's not broken. It's working fine for a few people. And
for now, for a very short term, yeah.
Yeah, wishing it were something different than it is not going to make it something better than it is. We should strive for excellence in that and other things, and I appreciate people taking actions that will turn this ship in somewhat of a right direction in the time we have left. But I don't think we're going to get there. I think every president in my life has been the worst president in my life.
Let's go to our next caller, Boris. And after that, let's get back into discussing abrupt climate change and things like that and take a little further. So, Boris, what have you got to contribute here?
Well, I heard Guy speak on Monday as well, and while his conversation dealt with a lot of hard science, I also was aware of a pretty strong undercurrent of philosophy and psychology, which has always interested me more than hard science when it comes to describing the human predicament on this rock. And I would like to hear him talk a little bit more about that, maybe even focus some kind of discussion on that. And I'm talking about social engineering, propaganda, word manipulation. And as a perfect example of that, I would like to challenge the term that's widely used everywhere now, climate change. It's my understanding that term was actually generated by a right-wing think tank to allow for the immediate default position of, well, the climate has changed many times in Earth's history. This is just another example of that, to deflect away from any kind of human cause for climate change, where the more appropriate term would be climate disruption, which allows for the human element. So I'd like to hear his comments about propaganda and social engineering as a cause of where we're at today.
Yeah, I think Edward Bernays nailed it, and we've been following the Edward Bernays school of thought as if it were some sort of textbook. There's abundant evidence at this point that, for example, the public school system in the United States was designed specifically to dumb down the populace. This goes back to United States Senate documents from the late 1800s, pointing out that the system that was in place then was producing children who were actually too smart. They were questioning the system, and we can't have that. So, of course, there has been an element of social engineering, hard, soft, depending on how you want to look at that, and that has taken us to the abyss, which we are staring directly into now. And that has unquestionably led people to believe that things like this is the only way to live, and therefore we need to live this way. There's, you know, we can go deep back in history and try to figure out at what point we took a wrong turn. And people ask me on a pretty regular basis, at what point did we make the misstep, the fatal misstep that took us to this point? And I'd say we made, as a species, we made thousands of decisions over time. And as nearly as I can tell, every one of those forks in the road we came to, we took the wrong turn. Everyone so far. So, I don't know, it may be that we're just flawed organisms. It may be that we are susceptible, because of the way our brains are wired, to the Edward Bernays school of thought. And so we have to follow that next dollar, or hope for that next dollar, or think that that's going to improve our lives somehow. And that's what lands us here. But personally, I tend not to focus on those things, because I talk all we can about the past, but I don't think we have long into the future, and focusing on the past doesn't allow me to live with urgency and to pursue my version of excellence and my version of love for those around me. So if that's your passion, I encourage people to go for it, but it's not my passion, and I don't think there's anything we can do, although, as Jackson Brown pointed out quite some time ago, sometimes it would be easier to change the past.
Well, I understand Mike had something more to say. He was either cut off or cut himself off early. But let's hold off, Mike, just a second. My one quick response to what you said, because I am one who's focuses, perhaps obsessed sometimes with the origins of the mess. But you know, I came upon a book recently that actually asserts that Caucasians in particular were deranged by as the species had developed, you know, out of Africa and this whole long arc, that were particularly deranged because they ended up in the northern latitudes during the last ice age, and that created basically a traumatization, and they kind of got their culturally deranged, which led in a particularly aggressive direction. That the author asserted that Caucasians are actually more aggressive than others of actually a somewhat aggressive species. But anyway, we'll bracket that. But also the whole issue that Boris brought up of climate disruption, climate change. I've heard that too, that climate change was, someone in the Bush administration. I think that's an excellent point. Climate forcing is also an interesting phrase that, you know, goes back to what I wanted to get back to talk about before we let Mike back on here. The whole issue of, if you look at the whole arc of the climate, and that graph you put on showing the you know, these plateaus and then relatively brief troughs and then plateaus, mainly, as you said, at 22 degrees, sometimes more briefly at 12 degrees, and then a few other odd anomalous ones like the one we've been in, you know, for the past 10,000 odd years, the Holocene, since the last ice age, which has been this kind of strange interlude that happened at a time in our species history that we were ready to make these technological leaps that led to civilization and allowed in this remarkable stability of a warm climate and these remarkably fertile soils as a legacy of the glaciation that just led to this set of circumstances that allowed for this whole civilizational complex, which is unfortunately, also are undoing. So that climate forcing, what you're basically talking about is that, you know, there's been, we've come out of ice ages many times. There's been this gradual increase of carbon dioxide. There's been, you know, these volcanic events. There's been these asteroid events. Just condense it all to a nutshell. But what we're doing in the past 250 years is something new. There's never been this massive burning of these legacy fossil fuels that have added so much carbon dioxide in such a short period of time in this framework of time. Isn't that what's happening?
Yeah, and I love the term anthropogenic climate disruption. I think Dar Jamail, the journalist who lives in Port Townsend, Washington, actually coined that phrase, and I think it's particularly appropriate. Anthropogenic, meaning human, climate disruption, which focuses on the abrupt change and the abruptness of the change. But yes, the forcing that you're talking about that results from fossil fuels is what makes physicists like James Hansen and a few other climate scientists so relevant to this situation. Because carbon dioxide does act as a blanket, a heat blanket. It has a certain forcing with respect to how much the planet will warm when we add carbon dioxide. And that's why Hansen pointed out that 350 parts per million carbon dioxide was the absolute upper limit. He suggested really that we shouldn't exceed 325 parts per million carbon dioxide. And when we came out of the last ice age, we were at about 280 parts per million. So going into the Industrial Revolution, we were at about 280. That's probably, if we wanted to ensure human persistence into the future, we probably should have stuck there. But now we have exceeded 350 parts per million quite a long time ago, 30 years or so ago, and that has triggered these self-reinforcing feedback loops like melting of the Arctic ice and the reduction in albedo that results, the release of methane, hydrates, clathrates from the relatively shallow Arctic seabed, release of methane from the permafrost, and the list goes on and on. So those are the forcing factors that take us to where we're at, that have us not just staring into the abyss, but having already jumped, and we're in this Wile E. Coyote moment that has us running our feet as fast as we can, but we're still going down, and we just haven't looked down to notice yet.
Well, with that, let's bring Mike back on. You got another comment or question?
Well, I'll make three real quick points. This living your life with urgency, excellent point, excellent idea. You guys are way over my head and great. But just really quickly, this business about white people being the Greeks honored war, and, you know, so many of the Caucasian races honored and thought war was so great. And real quick, I'll make two quick points. Dwight D. Eisenhower and Edward R. Murrow both said the same thing Jackson Brown was saying, that, you know, we are in a period where the thing is nothing but a bunch of wires and colored lights if we don't use it to teach.
All right. Well, thank you,
okay,
Mike.
Thank you, guys. You guys are wonderful. Just living your life with urgency. You're right. We're on the precipice. This is the end. So I'll be quiet and listen to you guys. You're on the right track. God help us all.
All right. With that, let's go to Leanne, our next caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. So it's been interesting listening to everyone. I am very interested in this urgency concept as well. And I follow a lot of different groups that guys in on Facebook. And, you know, I've been looking at these issues for a long time myself, back when it was just let's save the environment, you know, kind of thing, and let's look at fresh water and let's look at this and that. And now it's gone way, way, way beyond what any of us meant, you know. And so I was just wondering if Guy could elaborate a little bit on the real risks there and the potential for how this is actually going to become real sudden, real quick with methane in the atmosphere, because I think we all talk about CO2 all the time, but I don't think very many people really understand methane that well.
Okay, before we go to Guy, I just want to alert our listeners to the fact that the caller just said a word that absolutely cannot be said on the air, so I had to press the dump button, which erases several seconds. So our caller, I would admonish all callers to be very careful of that, because we do have a certain legal things that we face. So Leanne was talking about the methane monster. Go ahead, Guy.
So we can say methane on this program? Because the U.S. government seems to think that's taboo. You know, methane is at least 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide over short periods of time. And so we release a little bit of methane into the atmosphere, and that's hugely problematic, to say the least. So each part per billion of methane in the atmosphere is tremendously important. And Jennifer Hines, an IT program manager of all things, managed to study that issue and speak about it in a meaningful way so that lay people can understand that that the methane beast really is a monster that we have triggered. We're now in the range of 2,000 parts per billion, about 2 parts per million of methane in the atmosphere. It doesn't sound like much. It's actually a huge amount. It's the carbon dioxide equivalent of at least 200 parts per million carbon dioxide. You add that to the 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, we're at the equivalent of 600, just counting those two and taking a conservative approach to each of them. So we're at the equivalent of 600 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, taking a conservative approach, and 300 was the Rubicon that we couldn't cross. It seems like we're in a bit of a pickle here, wouldn't you say?
I would. Sean, what do you say? Hello, Sean. Are you with us?
Yes, I am here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, listen, so, you know, in listening, I wasn't actually going to call in, but, you know, the whole discussion actually reminded me of a book anybody should read called The World Without Us, which is Alan Weissman's book from a few years ago, almost 10 years ago. And it reminded me there was a specific part of the book that always stuck in my mind, and that's specifically his discussion over what brought down, in his discussion with an anthropologist when he was in the Yucatan, about what brought down the Mayan culture. And if you don't mind, real quickly, I would just, instead of my own words, is to quickly just condense a few words from the book of what he talks about. And specifically, it's about the archaeologist came up with. And that is, I'm going to quote, I'm going to condense it, an unleashed lust for wealth and power turned the Mayan into aggressors. Society had evolved too many elites, all demanding exotic baubles. He describes a culture wobbling under the weight of excess nobles, all needing feathers, jade, obsidian, chert, polychrome, animal furs. Nobility is expensive, non-productive, and parasitic, siphoning away too much of society's energy to satisfy its frivolous cravings. Too many heirs wanted thrones or needed some ritual bloodletting to confirm their stature. Dynastic warfare heightens. As more temples need building, the high caloric demand on workers requires more food production.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, well, I know there's a lot. And he just talks about specifically that war itself increases population because rulers require cannon fodder. But he goes on to say, when you examine societies just as self-confident as ours that unraveled and were eventually swallowed by the jungle, you see that the balance between ecology and society is exquisitely delicate. If something throws that off, it can all end. And he goes on to say, 2,000 years later, ironically, someone will squint like myself over the fragments trying to find out what went wrong.
If there's anyone to look at it.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, there's a difference between here in 2,000 years, but the symbolism of saying, you know, that even then, you know, it was a smaller population. But he was saying that it wasn't even overpopulation at that time. What it really was is that the more and more they became aggressors, the more they concentrated their powers and had to go within everybody to defend themselves.
Yeah, elite rule has always been a problem. That's for
right,
sure.
And we're all a part of the problem, ultimately. I mean, if everybody's still driving cars and so forth, that's the thing. But the one thing that remained with me about that part is the fact of the amazing amount of waste and energy that so-called kings and power structures and nobility take up And if people are shown to be left themselves, because, you know, even just simply reading the book Nickel and Dime by Barbara Ehrenreich about, you know, people living, you know, low-wage jobs and so forth and having to live under authority, is that if people are left up to themselves, they actually work very well in cooperation and get things done better than so-called management and authority.
Right. And the thing about capitalism, you know, people, anyway, capitalism in some ways, What it does is because of the vast apparatus of machinery and mass production and the replication, basically the replication of kind of the in some ways the luxury items of the rich disseminated. That's like in some ways our undoing has been. Everybody can, you know, everybody aspires to live like a king or where, as it were. But let's let Guy respond to that, and then we have one last caller to get to.
Yeah, but I just simply want to say it's not just. But what it brings to point is, it's not just capitalism. It's not just white people being crazy. You know,
right, right. Well, that's an extremely long conversation.
You know, Barbara Ehrenreich talked about. You know, even then, it's a dictatorship. You know, it's what comes down into all those situations. Is the concentration and corruption of power that ends up creating the downfall.
Fair enough. Guy?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about that for many, many, many semesters. The concentration of power, the ability to lock up food, the civilization that depends upon the storing of food and therefore the controlling of people, the consumption of materials at a rapid rate along with the number of people involved consuming, all that comes into play.
Okay, well, let's go to our maybe our last caller. We'll see. We might have room for another. Sheila, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, well, I hear a great deal of reluctance. A number of us have called and said, you know, what do you see as the scenario? What is the time frame? And there's a great deal of reluctance on your part to even say anything. And you say, I think you said it's imminent. And you're talking. Are you talking about in the time frame of our lives or in the time frame of civilization? I see this as something that can happen within a matter of even a year, where suddenly the climate has changed to the extent that there's not enough oxygen or whatever, and there's not enough food, or there's too much water. But I see I hear a great deal of reluctance on your part to even be more defined in what you see as the end times. And the time frame within that could happen.
I guess I need a little more clarity here on what you're asking. Are you asking for
a number of us have said, well, what do you see as this time frame, and or how will it happen? That we have a short time. I mean, you've said this a number of times this morning, that we have little time, live for now, and little time. I mean, if you're 20 years old, a little time can be, you know, 50 years. But if you're 80 years old, a little time can be, well, maybe we only have another year on this earth as a livable earth.
I promise we don't have 50 years. The world's oldest human being turned 117 years old in March of 2015, and on her 117th birthday, she asked what that felt like, and she said, quote, "It seemed rather short." We certainly don't have 117 years. Based on the material I presented, we don't, in my presentation on Monday, and that I'll continue to present as this tour unwinds, we don't have 10 years. We probably have quite a bit less time than that with habitat for humans on the planet. So I don't know how to be any more clear about this. We don't have long. And I don't, you know, you could get hit by a bus today, but I think we don't have long for the human species with habitat on this planet.
Yeah, I see it as probably within 5 years, and maybe even much shorter than that.
Well, certainly civilization can go away pretty much any moment. These things can unfold at an exponential rate as they are doing now.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing, and that's what I've been hearing you avoiding is saying that it could be just a matter of a couple of years.
Well, it just took you to force the issue, and so thank you for calling so much. We only have like 2 minutes left. I thank all our callers. Unfortunately, we can't get to Les. It's always good to call early, and I know it's sometimes you just don't get your question or comment until you've heard a lot more, so I apologize to Les. So, Guy, you're going to be touring around Cascadia, around the Northwest for a while. Where are you going to be next?
I'm going to be in Seattle, West Seattle. You can find all the information at guymcpherson.com on the coming events tab. So just click on there, because I don't have it in front of me right now. I have four more formal presentations to go, and I'll be shooting video in a studio to make a little movie or two. I think that's tomorrow. So the formal presentations, though, if you arrive early at those, I will too, and we can hang out and chat a bit and stay late, and we'll continue the chat after the formal presentation. You can find all four of those under the coming events tab at guymcpherson.com.
And one thing I had said at the outset we were going to hopefully talk about, we won't, but you can go to Nature Bats Last website to talk about these really difficult issues of how do we psychologically deal with this? How do we find other people to talk about it? Because it's hard to go through these things alone. Abrupt climate change, how will you show up during humanity's final chapter is on the homepage. That's what it says. So I encourage people to go to that as well. You can listen to this in its entirety if you haven't yet by going to kboo.fm and go to Wednesday Talk Radio. You'll find all my board, Paul Roland, R-O-L-A-N-D. You can communicate with me by going to Paul R. Kboo, K-B-O-O, at gmail.com. Again, GuyMcPherson.com is Guy's website. Last thoughts for us, Guy.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity again, Paul, and thanks to all the callers for calling in. I look forward to meeting even more people as the tour unfolds. I encourage people to dig into the evidence that I present, most recently in a couple of essays posted at guymcpherson.com.
Okay.
And the long essay there. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Yeah, he's got a long essay. Yeah, you're quite welcome, Guy. Thank you for taking the time to come on again. He's got a three-part essay that continues to revise, so that's worth reading in its entirety. Thank you all so much for listening. This is Paul Roland for Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland.